listening to me? Can I talk to you for a second?
Oh my God, I was dying.
You totally have to hear this. Do you have a minute right now?
It's
really
important.
Right
important. Okay.
I just
keep it on the
time.
Just keep it on the time.
Welcome to the Overshare Show. I'm Grace.
And I'm Tony. And today we have our beautiful producer here, Gita Drury. I know, she's a fox. And she introduced us to Laura Dawn. Laura is an American political activist. She's a singer-songwriter. She's been the cultural director for MoveOn.org since 2004. She was also named the organization's national creative director in 2007. And currently, Laura is also the chief creative director for a full-service creative agency and production studio based in Brooklyn called Art Not War. So, Gita, tell us a little bit about how you met Laura.
I met Laura Dawn in 2004 when we were both doing work around the presidential election. She was doing work with Move On, and I was just like totally inspired by all the work that Move On was doing around that election season and a lot of the way they engaged artists. And Laura Dawn was a really big part of how they infused art into their political organizing.
I had such a fun time talking to her, and it was so nice to meet an artist who was so politically active because, you know, in my mind, there's this, you know, stereotype of the political person who is like, you know, a stodgy A-type personality in a suit. And to see a creative person who's approaching getting their message out there in a creative way is nice. And I can see myself doing the same.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a relatability to Laura in the sense that she had this political objective of speaking to people through narrative, through story, through art, through passion, through emotional triggers that I think everyone can relate to. I think one of the main, you know, roadblocks when it comes to having people be engaged in politics is that, you know, it's hard to have an opinion about something that's presented in a really complex and stale way. You know, it's like everyone can talk about gay marriage because they have a personal kind of opinion about it, or abortion, because we can all wrap our heads around those issues. But having a conversation with a random person about like sanctions in Iraq is more complex. You know, so if we want people to be politically engaged, we also have to develop stories and narratives in a conversation that people can feel a part of and passionate about and have the language within themselves to truly understand what's happening politically. And I think that Laura and what was happening with Move On, especially during that time, and I mean, they've kept the momentum, you know, for the past decade, is really looking at people who have the propensity to be interested in politics, but like inspiring them to have community around it. And that's kind of why I was so excited that you're friends with her and we got a chance to talk to her, because she definitely did ignite this interest in me when I was 24 and I was working with you around the 2004 election.
I hope you guys enjoy our talk with Laura Dawn as much as we did. Thanks.
So one thing I have to say why I personally really respect you is that since having my child, learning about the news is so daunting because I'm like, oh my God, she's going to be five and there's going to be no Arctic ice. And I just want to shove my head either in the sand or up my own ass. Mm. So how do you like deal with the fact that as a new mother, and you obviously care so much about your daughter and her future, like still maintaining your activism and your education and everything that goes on with the work that you do?
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because it's something I've thought about a ton, and I would like to write something about it. But, you know, you read all these books, you're trying to, you know, we're all like type A, forge ahead, take control of our lives, women. So you get pregnant, you read all these books. And it seemed to me as I was reading them that most of the books were about like how I was going to get my equilibrium back and fit this baby into my life, you know, and especially like what to expect. Like what to expect, I don't know, I'm a little down on that book after the experience of actually having her, because the thing that they never tell you is that you're going to be obliterated by love. And people try to tell you, but no one really can tell you. You know, I remember I had this one friend who every time I saw, she'd be like, it's going to be a love like you've never experienced. And like by the like 30th time she'd said it, I'm just like, in my, like the bubble above my head was like, shut the up. Like, I get it. I'm going to love the baby.
Your
okay.
Heart walking, you know, around outside your body, you know, your heart walking around outside your body is a thing.
Yeah. You know, the thing about that metaphor that everyone says that it's like your heart walking around outside your body is if you actually stop and think about that, that's, can I curse?
Yeah.
Fucking
please.
Terrifying.
And painful.
And painful. And painful and terrifying. So you're obliterated by the most painful, all-encompassing love that you've ever felt. And you're not just changed on some kind of spiritual level, but you're actually changed on, like, I've been reading a lot about evolutionary biology because of this film I'm hoping to make. It's about the history of the world, sort of, is about sex and war and all of that through testosterone. And so I've been reading a lot about the differences between male and female brains and male and female hormones. Your brain is literally changed forevermore, and it parts of your brain shut down that you used to really depend on, and parts of your brain that are just meant to take care of your baby solely sharpen. And so you're not just sort of like metaphorically changed or spiritually changed by the love, but you're physically changed, and you can't think about anything else but their welfare, I guess, for forever. But especially the first, you know, the first couple of months are super intense. You know, you'll be laying in bed, and I would hear her cry, and I would be like in that dream sleep, and I'd feel my heart. Like, it would just be an involuntary response to her cry. And I'd be like, holy shit, like, my hands are tingling, my heart is racing, and I have to go to her right now. It's really, really difficult because I found myself unable to watch like television shows that I had watched before. I found myself especially unable to accept any narrative piece of media that used the jeopardy or life of a child, like putting the life of a child in jeopardy. Like, it would just piss me off. So I'd be like, oh, don't go. Like, what are you doing? Like, that's so cheap. That's so cheap and easy that you would do that. And I felt those kinds of stories in a totally different way as well. I also found myself doing this thing, which I know is a little bit of a cliche, but every time I read anything in the news, all I could think was, oh my God, their poor mother. Especially, even if it was a perpetrator. Like, I would start to think about everyone's mother.
Right, the mother of a murderer, the mother of a terrorist.
I would think about all of it. And that's not an accident either, because everything that I've been studying tells me that as a mother, I think as women, period, we have a kind of much more acute and developed sense of empathy. But the minute you have a baby, I think that empathy expands exponentially. And so it gets much harder, I think, to face some of the darkest stuff in the world. But B, it becomes maybe more important than ever to face it. Because, and that's what I'm telling myself, because I really believe that we have a societal problem in how we view courage, you know? Courage is like rushing into battle, rattling your
conquering
sword, being like, oh, I will, you know, in the face of certain death, I will still fight. So I think sometimes courage is just It's just the quiet ability to fight again in your own small way, whatever that is, every single day. And so I feel like I've had to have more courage in the past year than ever, which is, you have to get up, you have to face these things, you have to do your work, because you can't just succumb into a kind of like primal fear about all the things that could happen to her, which would be very easy to do. And you also can't walk through the world like you're made of 1,000 eyes and someone's poking every single one of them. Like, you have to sort of figure out how to fit this new overwhelming love into your life and to make it work. And it's a really big thing. And it's just something that none of the books ever talked about. And I wasn't prepared for it. I guess the one lady who I was told me over and over again, I should have listened a little closer to what she was trying to say. So I actually try to say this to people now, like my younger friends, like, what's it like? I'm like, you know, I'm going to try and describe this. You're going to probably sit there and look at me like I'm crazy, but I hope when you have a baby, you remember that. I'm going to try and describe this for you.
One of the questions I have about, you know, you as an activist, and I think that a lot of people when they're young are really politically, or are more likely to be politically active and concerned. And when life starts to interfere as they get older and their careers become, you know, something that becomes more of a priority, they sort of care less about the world and more about their insular family. Where you've kind of taken this trajectory in your life where you're like, my career and my art is my activism in many ways. And I'm just wondering, like, how did that begin for you? What was that motivation to really dedicate your life to cause-oriented work?
Well, it's something that had been a lifelong interest. I come from a working class family in Iowa, and my dad is actually a butcher, and he worked on the kill floor of a meatpacking company his whole life, and which is funny because I have been mostly a vegetarian for most of my life, but probably because he was a butcher. I became a vegetarian the minute I left home. But he was a butcher, and he was a union guy. And it used to be that the meatpacking industry was a union-protected job. There's actually a great documentary by Barbara Coble right about this that called Hearts and Minds, American Dream, which is like absolutely amazing, and I recommend everyone to see that. During the late 80s, there was like this huge concentrated effort from the right wing to union bust. And one of the unions that was busted was my father's. And, you know, being a union protected meatpacking industry worker used to be a livable wage, full health care for yourself and your family, pension, all of that. And now, of course, it's not. It's mostly immigrant labor. There's a huge turnover. There's tons of accidents. There's no health insurance. In some places, it's almost like indentured servitude. It's like you have to get your tools and rent them from the company store kind of thing. Totally different situation. And that's bad all the way around. It's obviously bad for the workers. It's seriously bad for the protection and quality of the food. But what happened, of course, is that the discrepancy between the CEOs of those companies and the workers, which was like, 7 or 13 to 1, is now like 300 kabillion to, not kabillion, but you know what I'm saying? It's like
kabillion
300 or 400 to 1. I mean, it's a huge, and it's probably even bigger. That's like the last time I looked at that stat. Like that just went from here to here. And so it's part of the, it's part of the larger story of the growing inequality of the country. But what happened to my father is he had been working at a place called Filan's Meatpacking for 13 years. And he went to work one day and the place was padlocked and they stole their pensions. They stole their last paychecks, everything. It was just, they locked it up. They're like, if the union won't bust, we're out of here.
How long had he worked there?
13 years. So, and that was a really big disaster for my family at that moment, and just kind of set off a series of events that was, I feel like my dad in some ways never really recovered from that. Like just the idea that like 13 years of a pension that he'd paid into and all this stuff could just be stolen like that. And a bunch of the workers banded together and did a lawsuit, but you know, I don't think anything ever came of it. And he just actually decided to not even participate because he was so despondent. And it was the first time I had felt that like exercise of power between people, between sort of wealthy and moneyed interests, and how it, like to me, when people talk about trickle-down economics from the 80s, and some people when I first moved to New York would talk about how it was a good thing, I'd be like, you know, the only thing that I ever saw trickle-down was that kind of rash of shit, you know, and nothing trickled down to working-class families out in the Midwest. I don't know, it was probably good if you were a waiter or a bartender in Manhattan in the 80s because the bankers were like...
Even the word, though, it's like, who wants a trickle? Like, I need more than a trickle, please.
Yeah, no. Trickle-down economics doesn't work. I mean, they've had like 30... years now to prove that it doesn't work. So anyway, that was the first thing that woke me up because I just couldn't understand how they could do that. That seemed incredibly unfair and illegal. And how is it that like something so unfair and illegal could just happen? It was the first time I realized that things like that happened all the time. And there wasn't any internet back then, so I couldn't Google it, but I started going to the library. I went to the library all the time as a kid anyway, but I went to the library and started looking things up and I just got interested in the political process. And then I think really the thing that really made it become my life's work, though, was what happened in 2000. You know, I was in New York. I was trying to be an artist. I was in an all-girl punk band. I made a couple albums. We were touring. I got a record deal of my own. And then 2000 happened. And 2000 politicized a lot of people. It was the first time where, I mean, I personally feel like a silent coup happened in the country. I feel like an election was stolen, and it seemed like it was stolen in plain sight. And that got me really, really concerned. So I started paying very, very close attention. And then when the buildup to, and then 9/11 happened, I was here when that happened. Obviously, that was pretty traumatic. When the buildup to the Iraq War happened, then I got really concerned because I was even, I mean, I don't consider myself like a geopolitical expert, but even back then I was like, but they're not the ones who did this. That seemed pretty clear and obvious. So that was when I randomly met Move On. And I found Move On so inspiring because it was very easy to, I mean, there's, you know, I worked on the Free Tibet. You know, I worked on a bunch of different things. I was always trying to like help in some way. But Move On was the first time I thought, yeah, this could work. Like this idea of aggregating small dollar amounts from a huge, massive set of people to actually compete in the marketplace of ideas in the media with these big money interests like that, that just, there'd never been anything like that to my knowledge before. And it was really random. Almost on my way to LA, I sublet my apartment to this guy that I met at a coffee house, and his name was Zach Exley. And it turns out that he was like the sixth person hired at Move On, and we kept in touch, and I was the seventh person hired at Move On. And I was just like, holy shit, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe what's happening with this small group of people and the impact that Move On could have. And I just wanted to do everything I could. And so I had an idea that I shared with Moby. I had worked with Moby off and on. We had been friends in the mid-90s, and I had like sung on his demos for his albums and stuff like that. Like, we just used to get together and play chess, and sometimes he would use me as a singer. And we also shared a really deep concern about what was happening with the Bush administration. And we had an idea. He had just done this video contest for anyone could make a video for his latest album. And it had gone pretty well. Like 300 people had actually made videos. And we're like, that's really interesting. This is before YouTube and any of that. And so we thought, well, what if you let anyone make a political ad? And then we'll get like a whole bunch of people from the entertainment community, like film community people, like really great people. I'll reach out on your behalf, Moby. We'll put together this whole judging panel. We'll have people judge it too online. Like, we put together this whole thing, and it became this thing called Bush in 30 Seconds. Which apparently is the first user-generated political ad contest. It's like taught in advertising schools and stuff now. Which
very
should be
successful. It was really successful.
Yeah, yes, and it was wild because Darren and I were living like a studio apartment in the East Village at that time, and I had my desk was like parked under his bike, which hung literally like a foot above my head. I had to like duck to get out of it. And I'm getting calls from like every news outlet in the world. Like, it just like exploded.
How many entries did you get?
We ended up getting 1,500 entries, which was, I think, a lot considering there, like I said, there wasn't any YouTube, there wasn't anything like that.
How did people hear about it?
Well, I was worried about people hearing about it. So I did a thing at the time. I decided to reach out to, I got like a list of the top 100 liberal arts colleges and then also film schools. And I actually did a huge outreach to all of them. That was like one of the things that I was working on. I started working for Move On specifically for that project. And we got a ton of entries from those people. I just thought that they would, you know, obviously young people might be more interested. They might have access to the equipment because they're at school. And also it was a, you know, possibly tasty way to get noticed. Like, if you got in the finalists, you know, Gus Van Sant was going to see your work. All these great people were going to see your work. So
how has social media helped, and has it hindered in any ways the work that you've done over the years? I mean, that's a great example of, you know, have you done outreach before, you know, Facebook? How has that impacted your work?
Well, now it would be a lot easier. Back then we didn't have Facebook. I don't even think we had Friendster yet. I can't remember when Friendster came on the scene, but I'd never thought of using Friendster as an organizing tool. Now we use Facebook as an organizing tool all the time. I mean, social media it's only helped, I think.
Sometimes I wonder if it's sometimes the activism starts and ends on Facebook. Like, that's, you know, there's a parody song about, you know, someone saying, oh, the polar bears are dying, let's start a Facebook page.
I worry about that too. No, that's something that, and I also worry about a lot of organizations that do the bulk of their work online tend to do better in terms of raising money in a reactionary state. So, it's now like I'm on the tail end of a decade of this kind of work. So I've gone through, you know, every emotional, you know, stage of every emotion that you can possibly think of, from being the wide-eyed optimist to like seeing things actually have impact, to seeing things not have so much impact, to being a little jaded, to like coming around to loving it again. I mean, my fear as well is that we have gotten to a place where, you know, online petitions, I'm not sure how effective they are anymore. When they first started, they were incredibly powerful because, you know, to get 1,000 signatures, you have to stand outside a supermarket and actually gather them physically one by one. The idea that you could get like 250 to a million people to sign a petition within 48 hours was crazy. Now, 10 years later, is that powerful anymore? Does Congress pay attention to it? I don't know. I mean, part of the reason I want to make the film that I'm talking about making is that I actually believed for a long time working for Move On that if we just elected better people, the whole thing was going to right itself and that we finally had the mechanism to do that. Well, I think when the entrenched anti-democratic interests saw the ability to raise small amounts online flourishing, what did they do? Citizens United. What have they done now? McCutcheon. So, I mean, now we're like as fucked as we can be. I mean, basically, there's no way to combat that kind of money. I think what we've also seen, though, which is encouraging, is that we might not need to. I mean, Obama didn't raise the same amount and he still won. And he won because of what they call the rising American electorate. And that, to me, is the most exciting thing. And I wish more organizations were working on organizing this group. But basically, women and people of color and young people together, when they vote together as a bloc, they're unstoppable. And that's how Obama won both elections. It certainly didn't win white men, right? So when those three groups vote together, white men, their vote almost doesn't matter, which would be the first time in history you could say that. I mean, basically, white men have dominated every election until the last two presidential elections. So I feel like that's like such a powerful message. And I feel like the more extreme right-wing versions of the GOP know this. This is why they're working so hard on voter suppression. This is why they're working so hard on women's rights. It keeps women pointed in that direction. It keeps women divided on a very emotional issue. But if we could ever get those three groups really voting in a super strong bloc, like, we could completely change the political system.
I mean, that just kind of blew my mind about the importance of, you know, pro-choice and pro-life. It's obviously not necessarily just about the morality of, you know, Christian faith. It's much more about the division of women.
I really believe that. I've come to believe that. I've come to believe after 10 years in politics that a lot is about the end game. And a lot of the manipulation of wedge issues is really about the end game of keeping, it's really about keeping these moneyed interests in power, these corporate interests in power. So if they can keep women divided by pushing these kinds of wedge issues, and then, you know, they stand a chance of staying in power longer.
That's another question I wanted to ask you about, you know, the far left or even just liberal or progressive people. There are a lot of factions. I feel like because when you're looking at the far right or Christian fundamentalists, they have this uniting force of their religion. We don't necessarily have that. So I wanted to know like a bit of your strategy of uniting people who have like a quite extreme variety of political beliefs, but are still considered quote unquote progressive. And then also I want to know a little bit about your experience of working with Occupy Wall Street.
Well, those two things actually go together. It's one of the bigger problems, I think, that progressives face is that there is such, I mean, they don't really want to be organized in a sense. It's the nature of being progressive is that you're kind of like, you really want to be an individual. You really want your political views to be seen as multifaceted. You really sometimes have deep political views and a lot of knowledge in this direction or that direction. So what you get is a lot of infighting that I don't believe happens on the right. Obviously, I'm not a right-wing person, but my sense is their message discipline, for whatever reason, is just far, far greater than ours. This is an interesting thing. We, you know, it's funny, they always accuse the left of like socialism and like then the right's about the free market. The funniest thing is that the right act like socialists and the left act like free market when it comes to ideology. The right are so united, it's almost like a communistic or so. They're so united in their messaging and in their dedication to a series of principles that have have been clearly shown to not work, but they just keep dedicated to these principles because, you know, I don't know, that's their thing. They are very good at that kind of unity. And the left is terrible at unity. It's terrible at it. And Occupy was a great example of, to me, a potentially, well, it was an incredibly powerful and unifying moment. That didn't last, and it didn't last because of that kind of infighting. It didn't, and from my perspective, from the different groups that I was working with, it just every time dissolved in a cacophony of infighting, and it just never was able to grow and flourish as a movement. I think it was still game changing and will always be remembered. And is the reason that we are even talking about income inequality, and is part of the reason that a candidate like, you know, Elizabeth Warren, or Senator like Elizabeth Warren can talk about this in a broad way. So it was truly game changing and really important, but it's not still really around in a certain sense. And that's too bad, because I feel like that could have been a hugely flourishing movement, but it would have had to solidify, I think, behind a set of beliefs. And it was too...
trying to prioritize them was too difficult.
I just feel like I feel like it's the same set of problems that comes along with any group that I've worked with. The difference is many of the groups that I work with are getting paid. So they can only go so far in their disagreement, because at the end of the day, like, for instance, you know, Move On. I mean, you know, and Move On's not perfect, right? But Move On does have a membership. And so if Move On isn't doing something that its membership agrees with or that it wants it to do, Move On's membership won't fund it anymore.
It's accountable.
It's accountable to its members, but it literally can't operate. There isn't any, you know, people love to say online that, like, George Soros is funding Move On. It's not true. It's never been true. Move On runs solely on small dollar donations from its members, solely and completely. There's nobody behind the curtain giving big dollar amounts. They actually couldn't. It's a PAC. You can't give more than $5,000 per person. So Move On has to answer to its membership, or it literally won't exist. There'll be no funding to pay people's salaries. So that's a kind of level of accountability that Occupy just didn't have. Now, in some ways, that was wonderfully freeing for Occupy, because they were able to say things and say them in a way that Move On maybe wouldn't. But on the other hand, there was no accountability. So there was... When two sections of the movement would get into a fight or get into a loggerhead, it would just explode. Like, it would never be resolved.
You can only stay on your soapbox so long before you need a sandwich.
Yeah.
And some shelter.
Another question I have about, in terms of, you know, the left and the progressive movement, is that a lot of young people, you know, kind of come with the philosophy that if voting counted, it would be illegal. You know, and that just have such a vast and, like, visceral distrust of the government and, you know, the corporate relationship that, you know, big business has to media as well as, you know, politicians, that they just feel completely impotent and paralyzed, because it's just like, it's all of it's bullshit. So, I mean, how do you deal with, or is it even a priority of yours to, like, you know, deal with young people who are maybe even overeducated when it comes to all the information and quote unquote, like, conspiracy theories that the internet provides, and then just feels like, fuck it, I'm just going to take bong hits and not do anything, when really they, you know, could be really impassioned and active, but they just don't have any belief.
They're going to be like John Mayer and they're waiting on the world to change.
Yeah.
I like to slap him for that song. Well, I just really just, I mean, I just strongly disagree with that. I agree that the game is rigged, and I agree that the problem is the corporate moneyed interests and the fact that we're sort of like a corporate oligarchy. We're not really a democracy in any sense, or even a republic anymore. It really is a corporate oligarchy. There is socialism. It's just not going to the people. It's going to these huge corporations. And that's just true. I mean, that's not a conspiracy theory. I don't need a bong hit to come to that realization. However, I think it still, even though getting better people in office doesn't fix everything like I naively hoped 10 years ago, it makes a huge difference. And just go back and just imagine the last 10 years if George W. Bush had not been the president, and if Al Gore had been the president. And I just think that we'd be looking at a different set of outcomes. And I know, because of, you know, my experience growing up, you know, poor working class in Iowa, those differences actually do, that's the real trickle down. Whoever's in charge actually does make a huge, huge difference. For instance, I really don't think we would have the Affordable Care Act. I don't think it's anywhere close to what we need. I think we need universal health care. But it makes a huge difference to a whole lot of people. I mean, the one thing that I worked on a lot in the last, 5 years with Move On is healthcare. And so I've been privy to the story, the incredible, incredibly fucked up stories from a lot of people who, these are people who had insurance too. These aren't just people who didn't have money to have insurance. They had insurance and would be dropped and would be denied care because of their kid would have a pre-existing condition because they had this or that or asthma or some bullshit thing. You know, and also, I mean, I know people right now who have cancer who are fighting with their insurance companies every day. It is an incredibly immoral system that we finally took some steps to address. It is not perfect, but the idea that you cannot deny a child care because of a pre-existing condition, I mean, that's huge. If it's your kid, it's huge. And the idea that you can't be denied care for a pre-existing condition is huge. It's huge if you're born with diabetes, if you're born with, there's a million different things you could be born. I mean, the things that they tried to deny people care over were sometimes absolutely ludicrous too. So it matters, It doesn't always matter in like the huge, massive paradigm-changing ways that we want it to matter. Obama didn't get all the money out of politics. He didn't get any money out of politics. Obama didn't fix everything, and I'm quite upset with him on his foreign policy in some regards. But he got that done, and I'm pretty sure I'm pretty sure John McCain wouldn't have gotten that done. So it matters. It matters who's in office, and I think that for instance, I was talking again about the rising American electorate. If everybody in those voting blocks really felt empowered and really came out and voted, because only about half the country votes anyway, who knows what we could do? I mean, a lot potentially could be accomplished. So I really hope that people continue to participate, because the surest way to make sure that we'll never keep anything close to a balance is just to stop participating. I feel like we've lost a lot of ground in the last 30 years, but we haven't lost all ground. And in some ways, culturally, we've thrived. I mean, who could have imagined that we would have marriage equality on this level 15 years ago? I couldn't have imagined it happening. I mean, back in 2004, this was used as a wedge issue to beat John Kerry. Within just this small span of time, it's become something that the current president now supports and will probably be, it's on its way to being law in every state. It will be eventually the law of the nation, right? That's a huge shift, So these shifts do happen, but they happen slowly sometimes, and they don't happen with, they don't happen on the timetable that we want them to happen. So I feel like I really urge people just continue to participate, because I can't even imagine what would take your place if people didn't speak out and rise up and continue to vote and continue to at least vote some sanity into the political process.
Well, I think that's one of the things that makes you so impressive, is that you're sort of a one-stop shop. You're like, I'll organize it. And you also do the inspiring in some of your work, like your artwork. And, that's a great way to get people from, keep people from being despondent and bring them in. How does your artwork complement your activism, or do you keep it fairly separate?
Well, I try to basically take what I know about, if I know anything about communicating. I mean, if you tried to be an artist, what you're trying to do is communicate with people. And, I try to go to the people who are best at that, because sometimes the people, no offense to the wonderful people that I've worked with, but sometimes the people who are running not-for-profits and who do the organizing work, and especially people who are great at programming and making, organizing happen online, are maybe not the best at communication. A lot of artists, I mean, the one thing that we have on the progressive left is creative people. I mean, the one thing that the right wing really doesn't have is that kind of creativity. So I feel like the more you can harness that, and the more that you can actually reach people emotionally. Like when I first started working for the progressive movement, you know, a decade ago, people were never talking about storytelling. And I was like somebody who was like really into Joseph Campbell, really into sort of like the mythic archetypal, you know, this is the kind of like arc that everybody has to have. We have to identify the villain. We have to identify the hero. And now it's like there's like an online listserv of like, the, I don't know, maybe like a top 1,000 activists or something called Game Changers. And now it's just, everybody accepts that you have to know what the story you're telling is. Everyone accepts that that arc has to be that you have to identify the villain, that you have to identify the hero. So those kinds of storytelling exercises are now a big part of organizing. And I hope I had like the smallest bit to do with that. I think I helped contribute to that. And it's just a really big change. Is it perfect? Is it, you know, are these organizations being proliferated with artists? And no, not really. A lot of it's the same. And also an interesting thing for me is that there aren't a lot of people from my background working in these not-for-profits. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of people who come from families who have been steeped in social justice for many decades, which means a lot of people who went to Ivy League schools, a lot of really privileged people who are aware of their privilege. But I think being aware of it isn't the same thing as actually living it. And so a lot of times I felt like I was just the voice going, I don't think anyone understands anything about this. Like, I don't think your average person has any idea what you're talking about. Like, there has to be a different way to break this down. And so, and I would try things out on my dad. I mean, one of the best moments was trying to explain the Affordable Care Act, also the public option. Remember, that was one of the worst names in government history, the public option. It's like socialism on a stick. And I was trying to explain what the public option was to my father. And finally, I just got exasperated. And I said, it's just like Medicaid for everybody. It's like Medicare for everybody. And he was like, oh, that would be great. And I just had this aha moment. I was like, why didn't they just call it Medicare for All? Like, everyone in the country would have intuitively known what Medicare for All is. But instead, they called it the public option. Nobody knows what that is.
It doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything. And it sounds kind of vaguely, like, socialistic-y, something, you know. So how you talk about things actually really, really matters. And so that's the biggest thing I've tried to do is how do we get the heart back into what we're talking about? And how do we, and the way you get the heart back in is you get the art back in, you know? So that's what we've tried to do.
I mean, I feel like there's such brilliance to that in the sense that people, I think, often vote from their hearts and from an emotional place. I think that you and, like, of course there are others, have an exceptional understanding of like policy and the details of politics and how it works and lobbying and all of these things that aren't necessarily like sexy or interesting to the average person. And so for you to kind of tap into an emotionality with people, I think that's much more motivating. I mean, if the two wedge issues that you've already mentioned, you know, with abortion and gay marriage, like those are both emotional decisions. I'm not sure what either of them really have to do with politics. And it's just, I just have a lot of like interest and respect in this idea that I think in order to keep people active, like you're saying, and participating is like, we do have to connect viscerally and emotionally because that is why people vote more than anything else.
Yeah, and I also think that sometimes we don't, because of the emotional nature of those things, we don't get to talk about things really in a rational way. Like, I feel like I wish we were more of, this is something I think I want to make some kind of video about soon. We need to be a results-oriented society. We need to be able to, see, if we weren't so divided, right? If they hadn't, there's a thing called, and this is part of the film, but this is the thing I really want to start talking about. It's called team aggression. I think it's actually one of the secret levers of the world, right? And what happens is when you get in homogenized groups of men, right? When they, and this has been proven on Wall Street, they've done tests. When you get a homogenized group of men, their testosterone level rises, their cortisol level rises, their ability to assess long-term risks dissipates, and their acute focus on short-term risks heightens, which is great if you're out in the middle of, you know, the wild, your need to focus on short-term risks is much more pertinent to your survival than any kind of long-term risk. So you don't really care about sun exposure. You care about the saber-toothed tiger that might eat you. You don't care about, you know, you're not
the
thinking.
The urgent risk.
Yeah, you're thinking about the urgent risk to your survival, right? Well, that's great there, but that's not serving us so well here. Men also fire dopamine and serotonin when they engage in conflict and in domination struggles, right? Women, on the other hand, fire serotonin and dopamine when we share information, when we collaborate, when we reach consensus. Women have a much different, our brains work much differently than men's. Not better or worse, but just differently. Our brains are smaller. Our corpus callosum is larger, though. And so when women absorb information, basically our left brain and our right brain are working all the time and communicating all the time, because the corpus callosum is sort of like the big center. It's like command control center.
The frontal lobe, is that part of the frontal lobe?
Oh, no. Now you're asking me a question I can't answer. I believe so. But I know it's the thing that connects both sides of the brain.
I just want to use this in an argument with my husband when we get into
a it's a good argument. It's a good argument. Well, and there's some good things that his brain does too. So his corpus callosum is smaller. And his brain is much more specialized, right? So, like, for instance, they always say men are better directions. I think they kind of are, because if you read about the differences in male and female brains, they're much better at spatial reasoning than we are, because an entire side of their brain lights up, and it's specific to that. And if you think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, of course it would be. If you're going out hunting, it's great to be able to map in your brain where you've been, where the danger is, where the food is, all that kind of stuff. So it would make sense that evolution would favor men who were better and better and better at that, right? They're the ones who would stay alive. If you remember where the danger is, if you remember where the food is. So this part of their brain is really, really overly developed. That's a long way. I'm going to go all the way back to team regression. But what happens, unfortunately, is in order to stay alive, men also develop this thing where they can get very, very deep emotional bonds to their in-group, right? Whoever's in their tribe, and completely dehumanize outside of it. And I feel like once you're aware of this tendency in humanity, you can see it everywhere. And so what we have is this incredibly, this bullshit divide between the right and the left, right? I mean, we probably all care about our children. We all want the world to keep turning. We all want people to have safety and to have enough to eat and to have good jobs, blah, blah, blah. But they utilize the things that divide us all the time in order, I think, to keep status quo and to actually enhance the power structure of the moneyed interests behind the government. I'm sorry to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I really believe this to be true at this point, because I see these wedge issues coming up over and over and over again. And they're ultimately meaningless, but they're harped on and they're moved on in such a huge way that it's impossible to not think of it as a long-term strategy. And so I think that one of the things that I want to talk about in the film that I'm trying to make, which is called Men, I'm trying to be provocative, is to talk about how team aggression, I mean, look what's happening in Russia. Like, could you have a better example of team aggression? From like what happened in Steubenville, Ohio, to what's happening on a geopolitical level, to what happened in Wall Street, where they did tests and they found these hugely elevated measurements of testosterone in the bankers there. It's dangerous, and it's not like this world is going to have to move from a world that's meeting each other in times of domination and aggression. It's going to have to collaborate. It's going to have to start having consensus building. Otherwise, we're never going to be able to address things like climate change, which is becoming like such a problem that we're facing the planet being uninhabitable for human beings. What, 1,000 years? Could be, right? That's pretty big. And so it's hard for us to do the long-term risk assessment. So I'm hoping through this film to have this really interesting and very geeky scientific conversation that makes women feel it's actually so necessary for us to become a powerful voting bloc, because we're never going to really take our place in the halls of power in this country until we have paid family leave, until we have real maternity care, until a bunch of things that other countries already enjoy are in place in this country. How can you really lean in to your work, to the workforce? How can you be on the board? How can you be a major leader from the local level to the national level when we have such terrible policies towards women in this one of the wealthiest countries? This, you know, what are we, the wealthiest country? I think we're still the wealthiest country. I know China's finally surpassed our GDP, but we're either the wealthiest country in the world or right up there, right? It makes no sense. So that's what I'm hoping. Like, that's what I want to talk about now, because I feel like just being batted back and forth from this left-right divide and watching it for the past decade, like, it hasn't changed anything. So I actually believe, after doing like 2 years of research, I believe if we had more women, I'm calling it the 30% tipping point, because something happens biochemically to any homogenized group of men when you have like a 30% tipping point of women, which is the testosterone level comes down. The whole group changes biochemically. It doesn't work if you don't have this 30% tipping point. If you put one woman into a male-dominated system, her testosterone level rises. It's like, I call it the Margaret Thatcher problem. I'll be talking about this, like Moby or something, like, well, what about Margaret Thatcher? I was like, all right, what about Margaret Thatcher? But I believe that that's what happens. And that's what happens to a lot of women who get into a high, competitive, aggressive line of work.
They have to be more like men.
They have to be more like men just to fit in. Yeah. And what happens is that their testosterone level rises.
They almost become more ruthless.
They become, yeah, I believe so.
Okay, one thing I wanted to say, and I think it's really important, is that I want you to be my president. I like need you to go into politics, because without you leading the world in this country, I feel hopeless.
We're going to wind up underwater.
I know. And the last thing I wanted to ask you is just about your daughter and what has it meant to you to give birth to a baby girl?
Oh, so much. I mean, so much. I would have been absolutely happy, of course, either way. But it's... Well, like I said earlier, it makes me feel like, even though what I really want to do is just hold her all day long, I have to take breaks to do this work. I think it's important. I also, like, this is a smaller thing, but I actually think it's important. I feel her watching me with everything I do now. And it's actually changed, I believe, you know, I don't think that we have kids for self-fulfillment purposes, but I think it's changed me for the better in ways that I couldn't have predicted. Like a couple of times, you know, you don't have any sleep, and there's just all of a sudden I would see myself like being cross or short with Darren, and then I would look and I would see her just looking at me, watching me, and I would think, she watches everything that I do. And so for the first time in my life, which is a good thing, I really stop before I react to something now. And I think about how I want to react, because I'm a very, you know, passionate and somewhat reactionary person. And it's been a profound change just to stop and have the moment of, if my daughter is watching, who do I want to be in this moment? You know? And that to me has been huge. And I'm not saying it's like perfect. Like, no, I never respond with anger ever. But it has, I think it's been a really big change just to take that breath and to think about who I want to be in the world for her. I also... It has also brought things up, which I think a lot of people talk about. Like if you've ever, you know, like my parents just didn't have a lot of money, and some of the things, you know, that happen to kids when they have to be in daycare situations or maybe are not is like what you would help for. You know, I think a lot about how we don't support moms. I don't know if you guys saw this recent story. It broke. I mean, again, call it postpartum if you want, but I was like just in tears over this. I couldn't believe this poor mother. She had been trying to get a job. She has two kids. She's trying to better herself, and she had no care or help. And so she had them in her car with toys while she went to a job interview and got arrested for that.
Yeah.
Heartbreaking. And I just saw that, and I saw the mugshot of her with the tears running down her face, and I just thought, I cannot believe this fucking country. I can't believe that those were her choices, because clearly she was trying to get that job so she could take better care of her family. There's no faster route to poverty than being a single mom in this country. And I mean, I think all the time about, you know, I have a friend right now who's going through it, who really, really wanted a baby and is going to have the baby on her own. And, you know, I'm so lucky that I have a supportive partner, not to mention his family, is here, you know, and so, and that's huge. It's just huge, you know, like having his mom come and help us out with daycare so we don't have to put her in a daycare, to me makes all the difference. You know, we just went to the pediatrician today and apparently she's like really cognitively ahead. And I felt like I was like, yeah, you know, cause we're here with her, interacting with her as much as we can. And not everybody has that luxury. And that luxury is really about our family. His mom is here. She's retired. She's coming in and helping us out 4 days a week so we can get work done. And that's like, you know, and I always think all the time, oh my God, what would we do? And I know what we would do. You'd have to put her in daycare. And I know that people do. And there are great daycares. But in a place like even New York, I mean, the daycares around here that are good, we called all of them just to see, just in case, booked up completely. Like you can't, it's like waiting lists to get into good daycares. So it's really, really difficult. And you compare that with some of our friends in France. I mean, the creche system in France is amazing. It's a great job. It's a government job. You have to have all these different credentials, and parents want their kids to be in the creche. It's a great socialization. It's great. It's like a preschool that's funded by the government. That's totally, you know, like the people that work at those the equivalent of daycare or preschool, early education schools in France. Those are great jobs. They're great, fantastic jobs, and you have to have real degrees to get them. And I can only imagine what that would, I mean, how would that change things for working mothers in this country? It would change things exponentially. And also, you know, I have friends, I mean, part of the reason we waited until later to have her is that it was just untenable 10 years ago. Like, we're just finally in a place in our lives where we've created a work and living arrangement that could help that, but there's so many. I would have loved to have had her 10 years ago.
And that's just changed sort of in this last generation. I mean, my parents' generation to mine, we really, yeah, you have to make that choice later. Yes. A lot of times.
Well, I mean, and Robert Reich talks about this so well, but it's about, you know, it used to be, and this is, and obviously women should work if they want to work. Women work for all kinds of reasons. However, there are families who just don't have that choice anymore. And it used to be a choice, and now it's not a choice at all. Both members have to work. They just have to. There's no way to get ahead because the cost of living has continued to skyrocket and wages have stayed incredibly stagnant. Even I've seen that just in, you know, when I first moved to New York, I was a temp, right? I temped all the time because I wanted to be able to be flexible so I could do the band thing as well. The hourly wage for temps is lower now than it was when I was a temp in the 90s. But the cost of rent, the cost of food, everything else has skyrocketed. So just on that small and, you know, very realistic level, we're just not supporting people in this country. And I think that that hits mothers and families the hardest. I have a friend who just moved to Denmark. She married a Danish guy.
And sounds delicious.
Yeah. He's actually Pakistani, and then he's an interesting guy. Full health care. I mean, she just tells me about her experience, and I just like, I can't believe it. You know, even with full health care, I'm putting in quotes, health care coverage from a supposedly decent insurance company, my C-section cost us $6,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
is that?
No, that's
and that's not that. True. I didn't. That was full. I was like, I thought this was covered in full. Like, oh no, we only pay 30% of the this and 80% of the that and blah blah. And I was like, are you serious? $6,000? And they were serious. They were serious.
I could have, yeah, had a home birth. That's insane.
You had a home birth?
No. Actually, I gave birth in a car, but that's I was like, can we get a drive-through rate? Is there another way we could do this? Because it was in the parking lot of the hospital.
Holy. So, yeah. You know what? That almost happened to my mother. Did you have precipitous birth? That's when you have a really fast labor in under an hour.
Oh, no. Well, from beginning, like when we timed contractions to when he was born, it was 3.5 hours.
That's really fast, though. She had all of us in under an hour and a half.
What?
And she had my brother on the gurney. They came. She was in the car going, this is happening right here. They got her on the gurney and like,
yeah, I think I could have actually had him faster, but my husband was like, get in the car. When I was into the hospital. Like, yeah, so.
Well, that's great. At least it was over quickly.
So, Laura, I really want to come back when you're done with your movie because your movie sounds so good.
Oh, thank you.
I think it's going to be truly transformative.
Just starting it now. It's called Men.
Men.
Yeah.
It sounds awesome. I also want to make sweet love to your brain because I've enjoyed this conversation so much.
Oh, thank you, guys. Yeah. This is really fun.
So, Laura Dawn for president.
I'm so happy that you're doing this. You're just doing a series of interviews with...
with badass women.
I love it.
Badass bitches.
And if you know other badass women, who?
I do know some badass women.
Of course
women.
You do.
I'm sure
you
do.
I do.
Thank you so much. You're a sweet angel from heaven.
Thanks, guys.